But we're going to start off tonight and look at a subject called the Me Generation. How many of you have heard that term already applied to us today, the Me Generation? All right, so some of you are familiar with this. We're passing out papers right now, the outline for this. So when you get this, you'll see that the first question at the top says, how did we arrive at the Me Generation? How did we get there? How did we get to this particular term? And as I look back at it historically in my particular life, I realize that I can recall way back to the 30s. Now, I don't like to admit that. In fact, I see some of the styles coming in today that I remember my mother wearing in the 30s. And I look back and thought, oh, those were dreadful times. And now I see that they're coming back. So everything comes into cycles. If you keep it long enough, sooner or later it'll come back in fashion. But in the 30s, basically, as we think back of it in a historical way, we realize that the time of the 30s was the time of depression. When a nation as a whole is seeking for money and for stability, there tends to be a unity. Everybody is pulling together. Everybody is trying to get ahead. Everybody is setting goals. Everybody is trying to achieve something. There's a feeling of unity that we have in disaster that we sometimes don't have in prosperity. And so as I look back, I realize that the time of the 30s was a time when we were all holding together for dear life just in hopes that we could survive. Now, when we got into the 40s and we were into the period of war years, the war united us. The war held us together because we all had to struggle. We all had to get together. I can remember in high school the scrap drives we had where we really worked hard to go around the community and find every piece of scrap metal we could find and bring it to Haverhill High School and pile it right there on the front lawn. And we had the hugest pile you could imagine. And we all were united in high school because we were saving scrap metal. I also remember having an English teacher for English, and she had come from England, and she was doing what was called Knitting for Britain. Does anybody remember that? And I can remember at that time, because of my English heritage, I was helping her knit, and I was knitting things for her to send to the British Army. Now, that might have been heretical for an American to be doing, but that's what I was doing, and we were all excited about doing what we could for the war, so there was a unity. We were held together. We had a common purpose. We had to survive. We had to win. When we got into the 50s, as we got there, the time when I got married, things were beginning to ease up, and we could begin to see that there was a possibility that life was going to stabilize, that we were going to amount to something, that we were going to be able to achieve some goals, we were going to have some money, we were going to have the clothes we wanted, all the different things that we had been struggling for through the past generations. And so as we went into that period of the 50s, we began to see a time of prosperity and a relative time of peace. As the 60s came upon us, we no longer had a unifying purpose. We had a war that was splitting the United States down the middle. We had an unpopular war that nobody really wanted to support. And yet it was the kind of war that we needed to win, but not enough to do it. And as we played around with this war and lost many lives during that time, our unity of purpose in our country began to fall apart. As the unity began to fall apart, individuals began to become restless. As they became restless, they went from restlessness into rebellion, from rebellion into riots. And we had the period of the 60s, which, as we look back upon it, will always be remembered as the decade of rebellion. And as our young people rebelled, they wanted to put in a better system. Now, as they look back upon it themselves, some who have weathered this through, they realize that there wasn't really any better system. They couldn't come up with a better plan. And as they found that the dreams and goals that they had set during the restless 60s did not materialize, they became depressed. And many people have labeled the 70s as the decade of depression. And in the time of depression, as this has been called by so many people, as we have lost hope in new vision and new plans and new ideals and a new way of government, as we've lost hope, the country has become, as a whole, depressed. In any nation that becomes depressed, it seeks a way out, and the way out in our decade has been through drugs. And the drugs have increased and increased until it is a rampant problem in the United States. Now, as we approach the 80s, which we're on the threshold of, the social critic Tom Wolfe put the title upon this period and called it the Me Generation, because we have become now a country of lonely people standing alone. Now, how did we get here? We ask the question, how did we get down to me? How did it all get down to just poor little me? Now, when we look here, I've laid out for you a circle in showing you the various things that I, in my lifetime, had faith in. things that I knew would be places and situations that I could depend upon. And as I look at it, so much of the faith I had in some of these institutions has passed away. As we look at this, I remember as I grew up that I felt that in the world, certainly there was limitless resources. There was a whole world to examine, there was a whole world to get from, and certainly whatever I might need in life could be found somewhere in the world. And I was never worried that the world would disappoint me. And yet in the last few years, we have seen the oil problem arise. We have seen the crisis where we don't know for sure that we're going to have enough fuel. As I have visited New England in the last year, I have seen people with their thermostats turned down very low, people who have put locks on the thermostat so the children can't turn it up, people who are living in fear of not being able to make it through the winter because there's an oil shortage. And yet we know there must be oil, we know there are places to go, and yet today no one can find it. We're in a problem with oil. We're also in a problem with other resources. We have nuclear energy that seems to be leaking in certain places. We're losing our faith in that. And if any of you were in California in the summer a year ago, you remember the water shortage, a shortage we never could have imagined, that we could be out of water. And yet up there, people were having little charts on their refrigerators. In one house I stayed, keeping track of how many gallons of water they were using with a meter on their faucet, because if they went over a certain amount, it would be shut off. Now, our faith in the world and all its limitless resources seems to be fading. And so for me, and I'd ask you to do this as you go along in this circle, when you find an area that you no longer have great faith in, just cross it out as we go down this circle. Now, certainly, those of us living in the United States have always felt that we could certainly depend upon our government. We felt that the government was stable, that we could look towards it, that it would take care of our problems, that we knew we had the best country in the world, we thought. Now, you Canadians think differently, but we used to feel this way. We thought we were number one, that we were on top. And yet in the past decade, we have seen many things happen that have disillusioned many of us in our government. We've seen a president have to resign under fire. We've seen problems where in the Congress where we've had senators with secretaries that couldn't even type. We've seen lots of problems along this line. The GSA has been investigated. We've been tackling the CIA. We're trying to make all of our secrets laid out in the open to make it easier for our enemies. The FBI at the moment is investigating the president's peanuts while his brother is in dry dock after his beer binges. And even though he does have one sister who's an evangelist, he recently had one who was arrested for disorderly conduct for refusing to stop playing her harmonica in a restaurant. Is it any wonder that poor Wilbur plunged into the tidal basin to go swimming with a stripper? It's difficult to look at our government and feel that it's very solid. And for you Canadians, you have a few cute tricks floating around, too. Back when President Kennedy was in office, he once made the statement, he said, I figure that if you start out to be number two, then that's about how you're going to end up. And it's interesting today, as an article here by Hugh Seide on the presidency, he says, even while declaring that the U.S. intends to remain on top, the uncertain U.S. response to events and the constant babble of background doubts have created the aura that we may just be tired of trying to be number one. And he concludes by saying that the president is spending his energy explaining and justifying America's decline rather than creating a realistic policy to retain respect and influence. Just 2 weeks ago, I heard over the radio our Treasury Secretary Blumenthal saying that the nation is in danger of defaulting on its payments for the first time in history. When we look at our government, it's very difficult to have any great faith in it. And some of our programs that we really thought were going to answer everything have fallen apart, too. As we saw 10 years ago, that the social programs were going to save us. And we were going to take all the people who lived in slums and we were going to build wonderful apartments for them. And we were going to transfer these people from where they lived into better surroundings. And we were under the illusion then, sociologically speaking, that if we took a person who didn't have anything and took him out of a bad circumstance and put him into something wonderful, he would immediately become a new person. Now, we found out this didn't work. In one article I read, it showed them bulldozing down $10 million worth of apartments, and this was several years ago, and it said, government program to change people doesn't work. And it showed how when they took people of a certain type and moved them into a better surrounding, the people did not change, but the surroundings went downhill. So we found out that many of our programs that we thought were going to save us have just not worked. We've also found in our welfare system that there are many inequities. My husband has an employee who lives with his former wife and children. And he does not remarry her because she's on full welfare and the children go free to daycare. And if he marries her, he will have to support her. Now, I thought this is interesting. When we're at a point like this where the government, because of its programs, has actually encouraged people living together without marriage and many other things along this line. And this is discouraging for us to realize that the government that we had such faith in, that we knew would stand by us and that would support us and that would give us moral leadership, has begun, in many cases, to fail us. So myself, I have found difficulty in having much faith any longer in the government. In our military, we've just finished an unpopular war, which we didn't win. When you look at it objectively, it's almost laughable to think that the United States, number one in the world, was unable to defeat North Vietnam. Isn't it interesting that after it became unpopular and we no longer could go on with it, that we retreated, hopefully, gracefully, was the way we felt we did with it, and that we decided we would turn away from a bad situation and hope no one ever brings it up again. But as we look at it, we realize that our military doesn't quite have the power that we used to think it had. I recently listened to General Brown as he spoke on the state of the volunteer army, and he said that since we have had a volunteer army, the quality of the applicants has gone downhill. Now, it doesn't take a lot of brains from any of us to analyze that if your army is totally voluntary, that the brightest lights in the country are not going to decide that that is the career for them. And so consequently, because of this, even though it sounds good on the surface, our military has gone downhill, and General Brown said that if we were attacked, it would probably take a good 6 months before we could actually be mobilized. Now, when we think of this, the number one country in the world, it's rather frightening to realize that I no longer feel that I can have any great faith in the military. We have in the past had faith in our churches. The institutional church has been a bulwark, a strength, a bastion of stability and morals, and we felt that the church was going to hold many of us together. But in the last 10 years, the large denominations in our country have foundered. Their attendance has gone downhill. They have been attacked by the courts. Even the little church that I attend has recently been investigated by the court to make sure that their tax exemption is valid. We've seen one woman remove prayer from our schools. Well, most of us Christians hardly knew what was going on and did nothing more than say, isn't that too bad? Somebody should have done something about that. We've also seen the courts take away compulsory attendance at chapel from the military academies. My brother, being a chaplain, said that he was there at the time when this was taken away, and all of a sudden the attendance dropped to close to nothing. Any form of godliness in church, institutional churches today seems to be being stripped away. So if we're to look strictly at the church, it's very difficult to have much faith in the institutional church any longer. When I grew up, I was told that the schools were the answer, that education was going to take care of us all. If we only got ourselves educated and organized, that we could go on and become something wonderful. And if we learned enough, we could become great. And so I believed that, did that, and at that time it did work. But as I've been reading things on the schools of late, and as I've seen my own children go through the schools today, I've had to come to the conclusion, not just personally, but from reading, that the basics have been somewhat abandoned, and that it isn't so important anymore whether the child read or write, but that he love his brethren. And it is a wonderful, it sounds good on paper, but unfortunately what we do then is produce people who cannot read and write, and they don't even seem to have a lot of love for their brethren either. So it does not seem to work in that particular area. In Los Angeles alone, we are spending millions and millions of dollars a year on busing, an issue that has never yet even been put before the people. It has not been voted on. And yet the amount of money that's being spent on busing in that one city has meant that they've had to cut down summer school and cut out the music programs. So there are many things that are going when we haven't even had an opportunity to vote on it. And recently, a statistic came out that said that in the United States, that this generation that has just graduated from high school last year is the first generation in the history of the United States to be less literate than its parents. And I think that's really a crime when we think of that, and that's a new statistic that's just come out. When we look at this, I really can no longer have any great faith that the schools are going to help out the country. Our morals used to be something that we could count on. When I was a child, we were taught black from white. Today, it has all become a confusing gray, and we were told what we were and were not to do. It didn't mean that every one of us behaved, but we certainly had guidelines and principles to go by. And when we did something wrong, we knew it, and we knew enough to be repentant and to be concerned about it. But today we've been taught under the guidance of a man who wrote a book called Situation Ethics, and who has been teaching that around the country, and who was only the forerunner of many other people after him, that nothing is black or white or right or wrong, but it's according to how the situation fits you at the moment. And if you were to teach your teenage daughter, for instance, in the old days, you would tell her that she was not to go out and sit around with some boy in a parked car at midnight by herself, and you would tell her the consequences and make it very clear so that she would understand that this was not the thing for her to do. But according to the new moral standards, she may go out and do that, but she must evaluate at that time whether this is going to be a meaningful relationship. Now, it's hard for me to imagine that any 14-year-old girl out with the football star at midnight on top of a hill is going to know whether or not this is ever really going to be a meaningful relationship. But this is what we're told to teach our children. Not that it's wrong, but that they should investigate that particular time and see if this is going to be meaningful. There are very few standards left, and we're being taught that we should definitely do our own thing. I recently read a cover article in Time magazine on Jerry Brown, and it was most interesting to read one quote. It said that before he went off to Africa with Linda Ronstadt, that he thought it over, which I was encouraged to hear, because I wasn't sure he had. And it said that he had definitely thought this over and wondered whether it would be a political liability for him to take off unmarried with Linda Ronstadt to the jungles. And as he thought that over, one of his cohorts said to him that it would be all right for him to do it, and this is the quote, he said, because America in 79 is past caring anyway. Now, it's sad for me to think that we are past caring and that we really don't care what happens to anyone. Recently, I read in an article, again, a cover article in Time, that on psychiatry. And it said they had surveyed psychiatrists in the United States and that they had asked them about moral standards, and that 19% of the psychiatrists interviewed wrote on paper with their names on it that it was okay for them as psychiatrists to have sex with their clients if it would lift their self-image. It's rather difficult for me to see that there's a lot of hope any longer in the moral standards. We've always felt that our families were things that we could count on, that marriage was sacred, that a family was something that we wanted to hold on to, and that this was an area that was surely secure in our country. However, today, as we all know, that marriage and the family are considered unpopular. Living together, in fact, a statistic I have here in the United States, that there are at least 6 million men and women living together as partners who are unmarried. And we in California have just spent a wonderful month with the Marvins. And as we have been watching them, we have learned many things about the legality of marriage. And the California Supreme Court 2 years ago recognized for the first time that married couples can sue each other. And the Columbia University law professor Ruth Ginsburg said, "This illustrates the further breakdown of the legal line between marriage and unmarried union." And as we have observed on our television, the daily soap opera of this trial, which unfortunately is true, and ironic, I think, that they met on the set of Ship of Fools, we are trying to figure out in California if 6 years living in a Malibu beach house, three pregnancies, two abortions, one miscarriage, and daily adultery on a South Pacific island, and threatened suicide actually constitutes marriage. It's difficult anymore to know just what marriage is and what it's all about. Now, when I look at these various things that I have down here, and you look that from my point of view, it's very difficult for me any longer to have any great faith in the world, any great faith in the government, any great faith in the military, any great faith in the churches, any great faith in school, or morality, or even now, the family. And yet it tells us in the Bible and Proverbs that without a vision, the people perish. Without some kind of hope and faith, it's very difficult for us to function. Now, what does the world want me to do in a situation like this? Since this is the me generation, the emphasis on me, what am I supposed to do? What does the world want me to do? It's interesting that when this is all gone, it's right down to me. And no matter how great I might think I am, when the hope of the world lies only in me, it frightens me. I don't think there's any one of us that when we cancel out all the other things that we've had hope in the past, really feels very secure in ourselves. Now, what does the world want me to do? A beautiful term that has come out in this generation, we're all to do our own thing. You can do what you want to do, and I'll do what I want to do. And we don't need any standards, we don't need any guidelines, we don't need anyone to tell us what to do, because we are now free, and we're all going to do our own thing. In Judges 17, verse 6, it tells us there that at that time every man did that which was right in his own sight. And what happened to the kingdom at that time? The kingdom of Israel fell apart because everyone did that which was right in his own sight. Now, we think it's a new term, but that came right out of the Bible, and I like that better. Instead of doing my own thing, each one did that which was right in his own sight. There are many kinds of terms that I have gathered up as I've listened to people telling me their feelings of liberation. The term, we've got to get it all together. Now, that can be a good term. A new one that I've heard a lot of people using lately is we've got to all know where we're coming from. Now, not too many are interested in knowing where they're going to, but we all should know where we're coming from. And I found this in discussions. Let's all open up and say where we're coming from. We've all got to find ourselves. We've got to know our true identity. We've got to examine our id. We've got to get into relating. We've got to get into anything, but we must get into relating. We must be laid back. We must be our own best friend. We must disclose our innermost feelings to anyone who wants to listen. We must really be upfront about things. We must get into primaling and rolfing. We should look for enlightenment. We should mumble meditations, and we should get the true feel of other people. Now, these are all terms which one taken by itself might not be too bad, but put together in a large wastebasket, we can see that actually none of these are going to amount to a lot. Now, what's going to happen? What am I going to do when I start doing my own thing? Now, as I've talked to many women lately who have gotten involved in some of the programs that they pay from $200 to $500 a weekend to go to, and for those of you who think you paid a lot to come this weekend, it's nothing. When you consider that you can pay up to $500 a weekend to be insulted and degraded and debased and to be told that there is nothing good in you. Two women I've talked to in the last week about this told me that they had gone to these programs. And each one of them said that the basic principle in these kind of mind-expanding experiences are that they spend the first day in getting you absolutely emptied of any kind of morals, any kind of standards, or any background that you might have had. And they empty you, and it's a perfect form of brainwashing that you cannot, and it's even biblical, that you cannot be filled with something until you're empty of what you've already got. And the Lord tells us this, that we must be empty vessels in order that we can be filled with His Holy Spirit to do His will. And they're using the same principle here, and they're emptying your mind of any kind of symptoms of moral importance, any kind of ethics, any kind of values. And when they're empty, then they tell you that you yourself are a god. And one woman told me that she had to keep reciting, "I am a god. All power lies in me." Now, this sounds wonderful, and it has a good ring to it, and it's attractive to people, because everyone would much rather hear, "I am a god, and I am wonderful," than that "I am a sinner, and in me is no good thing." And so you see, the message of the world has appeal, and it is attractive today. So many are following this type of thing. This one girl told me that she was told that she should be, when she left, relieved of the necessity of any personal relationships, because she could now know that in herself was all things necessary to have a happy and a positive life. And therefore, that if she were to please herself effectively, she would no longer have to ever worry about any other person. And that if she should see someone in hurt or in pain, she would now be able to clearly look the other way and not be concerned. Now, this is what we're being taught, and we're going of our own free will and spending a fortune to be told this and to be taught this. And I don't know how popular these things are here, but in Southern California, I meet at least a person a day who has just come through this kind of thing. And when they come to me, they are talking to me because they have gone to this and it sounded wonderful. And they went home on a high. "I am great. I am able to do it. I can handle all things in myself. I can make it." And they went home on that high and they found out what within the first week? They couldn't make it. And that although it sounded good, what was missing? There's no power to do that with. There was no power within themselves to be that God that they'd been told that they could be. And then not only are they as bad as they were before, but how are they? Worse. Because now they've tried it, they've heard the answer, it's been made clear to them, they believed it, they were ready to go on it, and they got home and it just plain didn't work. And then they come to me in tears. "What am I going to do now? I've tried everything, and this is the end." There are many kinds of things, meditation type of things, that say if we only all think good thoughts, we'll be fine. All of these humanistic programs make everything come from me. I have to do it all within myself. And I don't know how you feel, but especially at the end of the day, I don't really feel I've got that much left within me anymore. And I really don't want the responsibility of all the world on me, nor do I need to feel that all power has to come from me, because I know I just can't make it. And this is the way many of them tell them. My husband had a man come to him, a young man, and he wanted to borrow some money. And when my husband talked to him about why, it turned out that he was taking a course in a certain one of these programs. And it was one of the science type of things with a certain name and label put on it. And I'm not going to mention it because I don't want to be mobbed by one of them tonight as I go home. But this kind of a program he was involved in. And the interesting thing is how these humanistic programs work. That the first thing, he got a wonderful thing in the mail that said, here is a test to take for your personality. And so he thought, everybody wants to know if they got a good personality. So he took this test. And it says a computer will run this through and send it back and tell you what your personality is. Harmless thing, has nothing attached to it that sounds in any way bad. So he sends in this thing about his personality, and it comes back, you have a wonderful personality. And we are going to have a course for people with your kind of great personality on such a night at such a time, and it's free, why don't you come? So he decides if he has such a great personality, which he didn't realize he had, he will trot over and go to this little course. So he goes over, he takes the little course, and when he gets through, it's several nights he goes to this, when he gets through, they give him a little certificate, and it says that he has a great potential for leadership. And what he needs to do is to take another course. Now, this next course will now cost $100, but he has got such a personality and such potential that he should take this. So he gets the $100 and he takes it. Well, he then took the $500 course, and the night he was trying to borrow money from my husband, he was taking the $3,000 course. Now, you see, all of this had been by flattering his ego, by approaching him that you are wonderful, and if you only can think positive thoughts and do what we tell you, you will have a marvelous and fantastic personality. Now, how many of us today are really being taken in by this kind of thing? There are also many things such as encounter and sensitivity groups. I counseled one lady in Indiana just recently, and when I was talking with her, she told me that her husband had wanted to find himself. And he had come out to California. We seem to have the weirdest of everything there. And he had come out to California to take a sensitivity training. And that he found a new girlfriend as they were rolling around nude in a love ball. Now, I didn't ask how that went. I really don't know. But I thought that was really all I needed to hear about that. Nude in a love ball. Now, it would be an interesting approach. I don't know that there are too many of us here that would feel that we would look good in that particular situation. But I suppose it may be all right for some people. Now, as we, as all of us are trying to do our own things, we in the United States, or at least in California, have decided that we're sick of paying for a lot of things, and we're just going to get right down to things. And so we have a new hero, a new folk hero, Howard Jarvis. And it says here in Time, in an article, in 1978, after 16 years of trying, Howard caught the crest of the national wave of discontent. And he succeeded spectacularly in selling his tax-slashing ideas. It was Proposition 13 was one of the most important political and sociological events of the entire year, and it transformed Jarvis into a national symbol of middle-class America's mounting anger with expensive government programs that yield too few benefits, big budget deficits, and intrusive government regulations. So we have decided we are now going to look out for number one. Now, we're also, as we're doing this, abandoning any restricting standards and morals, and this is being taught to us that we should not have anything that would hold us down and keep us from examining ourselves and from being laid out in front. We're also in a great pursuit of happiness, and you know, we're guaranteed by the government that we could have life, liberty, and what? The pursuit of happiness. The government's never guaranteed us we would get happy. It just said that we could keep pursuing it. And there seems to be a tremendous appetite right now at this particular point in pursuing happiness. We have people who are very willing to pay if anyone will offer them a good pursuit of happiness. I ripped out this paper, the Arizona Republic Women's Forum, and it tells here about a man who is a happiness hawker, and he's been spinning his own variations and laughing all the way to the bank. And it tells the different ways that he is showing keys to success and happiness in positive thinking and in inner spiritual motivation. Many of these use the term spiritual. Doesn't mean anything, but they use that. And he says, I tell all the people that every morning when they get up, they should say, I'm great, I'm great, I'm great. And I guess if you say that long enough, maybe you can believe it. I found a new article in Time magazine on the scientific pursuit of happiness. It says we've failed in doing it in a human way, and now science is going to show us a prescription and a formula. You notice all these nice little figures, a formula for how to become happy. Very interesting to read this whole thing. It says science has long shied away from the studying or attempting to explain that most subtle and elusive of all human moods, happiness. And happiness itself was all but out of style in the days of Vietnam and the urban riots and the burgeoning dope culture, and the trend of happiness never seemed quite to have taken off. It's been not really too popular of late. But he says now we're trying to find out actually what happiness is, who has it, and why they have it. And then it goes through all the examinations of what happiness really means. These products of the booming feel-good industry, that's what this is called now, the feel-good industry, invariably try to evoke happiness, but they seldom describe or analyze it. But they do realize that people are willing to pay for any kind of help in pursuing happiness. Now, isn't that interesting? We're all willing to pay in order to find some way that we can find happiness. Most studies so far confirm that happiness does not depend upon any single factor. That is, neither geographical location, nor financial status, nor age is a determinant of happiness. The happy are slightly more likely to be married, but unhappiness is anything but epidemic among the single. Neither the young, the middle-aged, nor the old have any special claim on happiness. And it goes on to say that there really are no answers. And then it asks, why are people happy or why not? And more fundamental, what really is happiness? And one man says, it's the overwhelming finding of all the research that there is no easy solution and no foolproof strategy for ever finding happiness. And Abe Lincoln once said, I guess people are just about as happy as they determine to be. And that's probably as scientific as we're going to get. As we look at the emphasis in television this year, we find out that one of our networks has taken a large lead. And it's taken a lead because of what kind of programs? What has ABC Network provided that has made them number one? Comedy. Things that are funny. A relief from the problems of the United States. And Silverman himself said, people want to laugh. They just want to look at television and forget their troubles. I'm not a psychologist, but I would imagine that that's the root of the current trend. People just want to laugh. When things get so bad, we try to find some way to pursue happiness. Now, another thing that we are told to do is to focus on ourselves, on our body. And we have a new great body culture going on today. And all of us are to try to get our bodies in good enough shape that we will all be able to go on our newly proclaimed nude beaches in California and look good. Now, I don't know how many of you here today feel you're ready for that. But we feel that that's the coming thing. And so if you're going to do that, I guess you do have to do a little work. Are there any of you here that would not have to do any work at all before appearing? This is what we're looking at. We're focusing on ourselves. And as we look at ourselves and the body building, we also realize that in the area of cosmetics, and I was reading this particular fact which startled me, that there's $10 billion spent in the United States each year on cosmetics alone. $10 billion a year. Cover article again on the success of Revlon. And it tells us in here that for every dollar spent on cosmetics, only 8 cents of it goes into the product itself. Kind of interesting. So you know every time you buy something that you are only getting 8 cents of value. The rest of it is for the advertising and other things. I don't know if you remember in Hamlet where it says, he says to Ophelia, he says, God has given you one face and you make yourself another. And isn't that what so many of us are doing? We're also told not only should we get our bodies in good shape and look wonderful and be great physical specimens, but we should try to live the grand life. And recently in the L.A. Times, I found this marvelous article, which will help many of you out. It's called Opting for Opulence. And it tells you that if you do not happen to have yourself the wherewithal to have a very fancy home and big cars, that you can rent them to impress others. And I thought this was helpful. And I thought I'd give you some of this advice here. It tells you, and I'll give you the names of these afterwards should you want one of these things specifically. It tells you here that you can rent now a Rolls Royce with a chauffeur for only $30 an hour with a four-hour minimum. And if you want only a Cadillac, it comes for $260 a day. And champagne can be served in any one of the cars that has a divider window. And the rental price includes the first bottle. I thought that was helpful to know. Now, if you want to have a boat, like you're having someone in, you want to impress them that you have a big yacht and you really don't, you can rent one, which they will say is yours. And a 98-foot power boat goes for $2,400 a day, unless you don't want to take it out from the dock. I mean, if you just want to meet there and have a party right there and don't want to take it out, if the daily rate drops, it says, to $1,200. But if you want a captain just standing around in a uniform, that's another $100 they throw in a captain. Now, if you want to have a lot of furs, it tells you here there's a company called Rent-A-Mink, and you can go in there and get whatever you want for various prices. There's one here for jewelry, and it says you can actually rent the very pieces that were used in Gone with the Wind and Mission Impossible, if that's important to you. And you can get... You can get a $10,000 set for only a $1,000 rental, but you do have to put down a rather large deposit, as you can imagine. It also says that if you would like to have a house that looks like yours, just for some visitors that are coming, and you want to impress them with how you've made it big since you got out here, that you can rent a house anywhere from $1,000 to $2,500 a day. Now, this is a good house. And it says the top of the line, is a mansion, 17,000 square foot Tudor mansion in Hancock Park that comes complete with a 7-car garage. I don't know what you'd put in it, but a 7-car garage, a double staircase entry, and a pair of stone lions guarding the doorway. Now, when you realize what you can have in life, you see, you can opt for opulence, and for not too much money at all, you can really look pretty good. Now, what happens when I go through all these programs that the world tells me to do, and I come up failing? I look at all these things and I found out that really doing my own thing hasn't worked out, that I have been looking out for me and I've lost all my friends, that I've given up all my morals and now I'm in all kinds of trouble, that I've been pursuing happiness and haven't yet found it, that I've been trying to make my body wonderful and I still don't look too good, that I'm trying to live the grand life and I'm just in a little apartment, and I look at all these things that the world has told me I've got to do, and what do I come up with? I come up with poor, empty little me. There's nothing left but me. And I come up with loneliness and boredom. I come up with discontent and depression, hopelessness and desperation. And we've discussed some of those things today. One of the ways that people are pursuing when they are lonely and bored is soap operas. And it's interesting here. I've ripped out about 5 different articles. You're groaning, but half of you, I'm sure, are watching them. And as I have discussed this with people, I found out that many are spending their time getting acquainted with people in the soap operas because they really haven't got any friends, because everyone's been told not to get too related to other people, not to get into it, not to get close to them, to stay unto yourself. And when we do this, we become lonely. And as I've read some of these things, soap operas, sex and suffering in the afternoon, and we find out what's going on, we realize that there are some, as it says in here, some woman wrote in, and she said, "I feel closer to the people on day of our lives than I do to my own friends." It says right here today, should you want to be caught up to date, and this is a little bit old, in fact, it's older than I thought, but just to give you the feeling of the kind of things that we're watching and getting related to, it says here that on days of our lives, venerable Dr. Tom Horton is presiding over 4 generations of chaos. His wife's religious faith is wavering. His eldest son, Dr. Tom Jr., has just recovered from amnesia. His second son, Mickey, still has amnesia and is now called Marty Hansen. Dr. Tom Sr.'s granddaughter, Julie, has been married twice. Recently, she fell downstairs and the baby she was carrying died. Julie is really in love with her late mother's husband, Doug Williams, but she cannot marry him because she feels guilty. Doug has entered into an artificial insemination program so that his child by Julie's mother may have a playmate. Unknown to him, his housekeeper has arranged to be the child's mother, and Julie's son, David, is now living with a struggling black family, the Grants, and falling in love with daughter Valerie. His abandoned girlfriend, Brooke, tried to commit suicide, and this month, a couple who are indecisive about their sexual preferences will be introduced. Now, if you're lonesome, you can surely find friends among that. This year has also been the year of telling it all, as the cover story here on Newsweek says, that we have an insatiable thirst to learn about the celebrities and all about their lives. It says here, everybody's into it. You see, again, using these slang expressions of the day. The degree of candor varies, but the aim at least is to satisfy what has become a huge national appetite for personal revelation. We're a people society in the 70s, said Joni Evans, associate publisher at Simon & Schuster. We have to know everything about everything. I think it gives people a sense of power. They think if they know what kind of sheets Jackie Onassis sleeps on, they'll be that much closer to her. A close view of Joan Crawford, drunk and crazed, ripping up her children's bedrooms in the dead of night, beats watching old Crawford movies on TV. A far better book, Brooke Howard's Moving Haywire, records the falling apart of an exceptionally gifted and glamorous family. And we learn from Doris Day, her own story, how she smears herself from head to toe with Vaseline petroleum jelly and then falls into a greased beauty sleep. And another paragraph in this new book, The Culture of Narcissism, The American Life in an Age of Diminishing Expectations, Christopher Lash says that the preoccupation with celebrity as a symptom of society in retreat from politics, without faith in any kind of future or without belief in any action. Interesting how even the worldly magazines are telling us that no one has any faith in anything anymore. Now, as we think about this, what are we going to do? It was a beautiful article in Glamour magazine, and I found this quite surprising because I didn't expect to find such a thing in there. And it talks about all these little programs that I have been mentioning so far. And the question is asked as a title. It says, are we being taken in by the new growth snobs? And the concluding part of it that I thought was worth reading to you, it says, like it or not, the world at the moment is not entirely a happy place to live. People still suffer from afflictions that simply can't be washed away. An inner joy or tranquility purchased at the price of ignoring the unhappiness or the agitation of others is arrogant, selfish, and in the long run, probably impossible. Of course, today's obsessions are not unique. Every period has had similar enthusiasms, but the most distressing thing to us is how the inventors of the new growth movements manage to mask their own unspoken biases. They continually preach doing your own thing, but what they usually mean is doing their thing. They deride old conformities while advocating new ones. What they and all of us should realize is that growth frequently focuses upon us and forces upon us the unsought courage to stand up and be different. It also includes remembering our obligation to care about other people. Any system that excludes these two difficult goals is showing us not a way to self-realization, but a new kind of tyranny. I thought that was a brilliant and unexpected statement in a Glamour magazine editorial. Now, we look on our second page and ask this question, is there any hope for me? If I'm here in this particular dilemma, and if I've crossed off my faith in the world, in the government, the military, the church, the schools, the morals, and the family, where am I going to look for? Now, as we know, there has been in the past always an emphasis on church as an institution, but today, even in our churches, we find in many cases not much faith, not much purpose, and really no discipline. Recently, the new Pope, John Paul II, said that my goal is a church that can once again offer a solid faith in a sea of spiritual confusion and uncertainty. He's hopeful perhaps he can lead in that direction. Sometimes even our pastors don't have a lot to offer. Recently in Time magazine, I found an area here that asked a question, do you have to believe in God to be a Protestant minister? Now, 10 years ago, would you have even asked such a question? And then it says down here, the answer, as in so many cases these days, is yes and no. We're neither black or white anymore. It's neither really yes or no. And then it tells about this particular man, Pastor Schultz, and he has preached since 1971 that the existence of a personal God is just a comforting invention of human beings. And he goes on to define that prayer is merely self-reflection, life after death is wishful thinking, that Jesus was a normal man with good things to say who was later glorified into the Son of God by early Christians. And as the examiners went over his lack of any kind of belief and faith in God, let alone in Jesus Christ, they reluctantly, the examining commission, after 9 years of study on this man, decided that they would forbid him to preach or administer sacraments. But in order not to disturb him, they are going to pay him $12,000 a year if he just keeps his mouth shut. I thought that was interesting to see. Now, when we don't have a real faith in the institutional church anymore, what we have been offered lately in this pastime is a following of various kinds of cults. In an article in Time, it says they know that in rootless, permissive, mobile America, many people are desperately searching for meaning and stability in their lives. And the cults offer a refuge from the storms of the world. They purport to know the truth of existence, and they tell you they'll help you. For people who are drifting and discontented, they can find instant comradeship and a sense of self-worth in a cult. And even in Japan, the society has become so highly fragmented and materialistic that young people are longing for communal solidarity with an authoritarian figure and specific behavior codes and guidelines. Now, as we study the cults, and I have been looking on this ever since the Jones situation, been studying the various aims and directions in the cults, and I found that they come down to several things that they all have in common. One is that they offer a father figure, an authoritarian being that people can worship and respect and have faith in. It's interesting how it parallels Orthodox Christianity, but it isn't the same. So they offer a father figure. They also offer faith in a system, and they offer a new purpose and hope in life to hopeless people. And then one thing that they provide that our churches are no longer providing, and that is a clear pattern of discipline. And it's interesting how innately within us, in each one of us inside, we do want someone to worship. We need some kind of a faith and a hope and guidelines, and we do need specific patterns of behavior and a disciplined society. And when we find ourselves as we are today without any of those available, then we find ourselves ready for cults. In thinking about the particular problem that we had in the Jones situation, one quote I like said that what united the people around Jones was partly a fear of freedom, but partly a defect in will that led them to surrender blindly to any powerful leader, any strong faith, things that somehow are not able to be found in United States society today. At the time that we were having this problem, the London Economist said this: what happened in Jonestown, Guyana, is a ghoulish cautionary tale for those people who in their differing ways are seeking God in a secular world. In that search for God, it is all too easy to blunder into the arms of Satan instead. And the West German newspaper said, the Jonestown deaths pose the vital question of whether in our modern way of life today, our institutions really provide any sense of sufficient stability. And the Pravda, the Moscow newspaper, said that Jones is a cynical and skillful operator who cannily took advantage of the massive disillusionment of Americans with their government and the whole American way of life. As we've seen this, we've realized that where the churches have failed, that the cults have tried to take over and in many ways have been successful. Now, what are we going to believe in as Christians today, and what are we going to do about this? Is there any hope for me? Now, always, as we read our Bible, as we study, we find out that Christ is the answer. And it tells us, the verse that I like here is in 1 Timothy 2:5, where it says, for there is one God and one mediator between God and man, the man Christ Jesus. And on your front page, where you have your circle there, what I'd like you to do yourself is to write out here in the space the word God. Because while I no longer have much faith in the world, the country, the military, the church, the schools, the morals, or the family of today, my faith has to be in God. And when you write out here, I want you to write this, write out here the word God. Now, God's out here, and little tiny me is in here, disillusioned, despondent, discouraged, and depressed. And how am I, as a little sad dot in the middle here, going to communicate with God? What does the Bible tell me? It tells me here that there's one mediator between God out here and me in here. And what is that mediator? Who is that mediator? Jesus Christ. And as you draw a connector between you and Jesus Christ, you see that the only hope for us in life is a faith in God connected to us by the one mediator, the bridge over troubled waters, Jesus Christ. Now, when we realize there's nothing else to believe in today, there are a lot of people who have never believed in God, who've never really had much of a faith, who've never thought that they needed to do anything but go to church once in a while on Christmas and Easter, who are now realizing that they need something. When faith and all the materialistic things that we've counted on for the years falls apart, we need to find somewhere to go. And here it tells us in 1 Timothy 2:5, there is one God and one mediator between God and man, the man, Jesus Christ. Now, how can I get beyond me? What steps can I take so that I'm not just left all alone in the me generation, just taking care of little me? In James 1:1-3, and this is in the Living Version, I like this the best, it says it asks this question, and I've always enjoyed this question, and some of you I know from talking with you today could go along with this. It says, is your life full of difficulties and temptations? Then be happy. But when the way is rough, your patience has a chance to grow. So let it grow, and don't try to squirm out of your difficulties. Now, wouldn't a lot of us right now like to, in a way, run away? I've talked to several of you today that if we could offer you a way out of the country, you'd take it. That if you could just run away from the problems, it would be the thing to do. But it tells us here that all of us have got difficulties and problems, and just asks us, is your life full of difficulty and temptations? Then be happy. For when the way is rough, your patience has a chance to grow. So let it grow, and don't try to squirm out of your difficulties. So the first thing, when we're approaching, what am I going to do with me in this kind of world where I have no hope and no faith in the institutions that have always been so strong to me before? As I look at this, what am I going to do? First place, not get discouraged and despondent. Not say the world is coming to a terrible end. Look at all these awful people. Look at all these awful programs. Isn't this terrible? Because it's so easy to do that, and that's what the world is beginning to do. And yet we're promised that for another 10 years we're going to be getting more and more self-centered, and that we're going to be looking more and more within ourselves and pulling away from other people and becoming isolated and lonely people. Now, what am I going to do? What am I going to do with me? How am I going to get beyond me? First place, then, cheer up and be patient. Secondly, Secondly, and turn with me to 2 Timothy, because this is where we're going to use a few verses here, so I want you to look at that. 2 Timothy 3, 1 through 7. If you have this, open up. If you don't, then look at it later. 2 Timothy 3, 1 through 7. And we're going to look here at the fact that these days were predicted. Do you know that years and years and years and years and years ago, that people knew we were going to have a me generation? That they knew this was going to happen? That they knew that institutions were going to fall apart? And when you look at it in here, in 2 Timothy 3, and I'm reading this from the Good News, but you'll follow it along in whatever version you have fairly closely, and it says this, and Paul is speaking to a young man, Timothy, who is a pastor, and Paul has sent out to help people in the Christian life. And Paul writes to him encouragingly and telling him not to worry and to cheer up. And he says, remember this, there will be difficult times in the last days. Are we in difficult times? We surely are. And then it makes an outline of just how we're living today. Look at these words. It says here, for men will be selfish, greedy, boastful, and conceited. They will be insulting, disobedient to their parents, ungrateful, and irreligious. They will be unkind, merciless, slanderers, violent, and fierce. They will hate the good. They will be treacherous, reckless, and swollen with pride. They will love pleasure rather than God. They will hold on to the outward form of religion, but they will reject its real power. Now, that sentence to me just so sums up all of these various movements today that are pulling people in and showing them how they can be great within themselves, but rejecting the real power, the form of godliness and religion, but rejecting its real power. And then he says, keep away from these people. Some of them go into homes and get control over weak women. How many weak women I've talked to that this has happened to them? Who are weighted down by the guilt of their own sins and driven by all kinds of desires. Women who are always trying to learn, but who never seem to come to know the truth. And I'm sure any of you that do any counseling at all are deluged with women who are always trying to learn, but who never seem to come to know the truth because they really don't desire to change or to do anything about it. And then in chapter 4, 2 Timothy 4, verses 3 through 5, it says here, for the time will come when men will not listen to true teaching, but will follow their own desires, and will collect for themselves more and more teachers who will tell them what they are itching to hear. And isn't this what we're being taught in all of these programs? What am I itching to hear? That I'm really wonderful, that I'm a God, that I have all power in me, and that I can do it. And when I hear that often enough, I begin to think, maybe I can. And it says right here, they will collect teachers who will tell them what they're itching to hear. They will turn away from listening to the truth, and they'll give their attention to legends. But he says, you must keep control of yourself in all circumstances. Endure suffering, do the work of a preacher of the good news, and perform your whole duty as a servant of God. Now, the Bible doesn't tell us things that are attractive. So many times, in counseling people, and just today for an example, that when someone asks a question, you can tell them what they are itching to hear. But in order to give sound biblical counsel, what do you usually have to tell a person? That which they don't want to hear. Now you see how opposite all these movements are from what the Bible tells us? We're not to be looking for people who will tell us what our ears are itching to hear, but to find out the truth in order that we may investigate ourselves in a positive and spiritual way and find out what God wants out of our lives. Now, what are some of the steps that we're going to take in doing this? I've already given you before Romans 12, 1 and 2, but I want to share this with you again, that this tells us right here what we must do, that we must present ourselves to the Lord, not to one of these cults, not to one of these different experiences, but we must each one sincerely and positively present ourselves to the Lord and say, here I am. I don't want to follow this other path. I don't want to be what these other people are leading me to be. I want to present myself to you. Present my body, my entire self to the Lord, not to the cults. And there are so many of us who are more conformed to cosmopolitans than to Christ. And yet this is what we must do. We must present ourselves to the Lord and do what is his will. And when we do present ourselves to the Lord, and for those of you who know that, say it with me, that we are to present our bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto him, which is our reasonable service. And be not conformed to this world. That's where we want to stop, right? Be not conformed to this world. Now you see, when we take it in this context, it has a whole different meaning. that it doesn't matter what your children are telling you, what your neighbors are telling you, what the people down the street that went to some great experience are telling you. It tells us here we are not to be conformed to the world. That is not our principle. That is not our aim. We are not to be conformed to the world, but what are we to be? Be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind. And some of our minds are sick. Be by the renewing of our mind, and then we will know what? What is that good, acceptable, and perfect will of God for you. Great, I'm proud of you how well you know that. That's a beautiful set of verses to know. And considering you know it so well, I assume that you already have done this. All right, then the next step, assuming that you are willing to cheer up and be patient and not to be despondent about the world and to give up and say, well, there's nothing I can do, I'm just going to go along with the crowd. Instead of doing that, knowing these days were predicted, presenting ourselves already to the Lord, not being conformed to the world, but being transformed, then we are, in 1 John 2:15, 17, it tells us to love not the world. To love not the world. To not put our affection on the world. To put our purpose on the world, our direction on the world. Not to love the world. The world and everything in it that men desire is doing what? What does it say? The world and everything in it that men desire. And oh, do we desire things today? We want things. We want excitement. We want the Rolls Royces. And we want the big mansions. And we want all these things. And many of us women are driving our husbands crazy trying to get all the things that our neighbors have got. And it says right here that we are not to love the world because the world and everything in it that men desire is doing what? Passing away. Now that's discouraging for those of you who just bought a new house and a lot of furniture. Because it says all that's really going to pass away. And it tells us, but he who does what God wants lives forever. Now, you see, when we begin to get our focus down on what God wants, we find a very different picture from what the world is showing us. In Ephesians 5, 1 and 2, it tells us, since you are God's dear children, and we're working on the assumption here tonight that you all are, since you are God's dear children, you must try to be like what? Like him. Should we try to be like the world? Should we try to enter into all these things? Should we try to be leaders out there and to go and to enter into all these various kinds of things that are being offered for us? No, it tells us right here, since you are God's dear children, you must try to be like him. Now, I love the way Paul writes, because Paul is direct. He does not fool around. I'm sure any of you that have read Paul, you realize that. When he says it, he makes it clear. You must do this. And he says you must try to be like the Lord Jesus. Your life must be controlled by love. Just as Christ loved us and gave his life for us as a sweet smelling offering and aroma and a sacrifice which is pleasing to God. Again, this word sacrifice, as in the Romans 12, 1 and 2, which means to give up the will and control of our lives and allow the Lord to come in and to direct us. And this is what is a sweet-smelling aroma to God. Now, we may spray ourselves with any kind of perfume, and it won't mean a thing to the Lord. But when we offer ourselves as a sacrifice, what does it tell us this does? This is a sweet-smelling aroma, a sacrifice to the Lord. And he sees that, and he knows that. He knows who are his. In 2 Corinthians 12, 9 and 10, it tells us that we should not worry that we're not strong. I've talked to many of you this afternoon who really don't have much more strength left. Some of you that are not sure you're going to go on another day. And I feel for you, and I have compassion for you, and I know the kind of feeling that you've got. And as I think about this, and as I realize these verses tonight, that this will be a comfort to some of you that I've spoken to this afternoon. 2 Corinthians 12, 9, it says, and Paul is speaking here, my strength is made perfect in my weakness. Now that's a contradiction, isn't it? In the world, I couldn't work at all. How can I be strong when I am weak? And then he goes on to say, therefore, I take pleasure in my infirmities, in reproaches, in necessities, in persecutions, in distress, all for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then am I really strong. And it's important for us to realize that when I'm at the bottom, God can really begin to work. When I'm on the top, I don't give him much opportunity, do I? Because when I'm in control and everything's going my way and I've got it under my control and my plan, I don't really need him a lot. But when I've hit the bottom, when I'm at the bottom, then God really can begin to work. Now let's ask ourselves the next question. Where can I find some guidelines for me? Where can I find out what I'm supposed to be doing in life? In Philippians 2, and look in with me here, Philippians 2, verses 3 to 11, we find some general instructions for life. Philippians 2, 3:11. I don't know how marked up your Philippians is, but when I look at this particular page, I'm not sure I can learn a lot more about Philippians. Because every time I write in a different color, it's a different lesson. And this one I actually didn't write in. I just want to give you some verses in here. It asks you, first place, let's look at verse number 1, because I like this question. We should maybe start right there. It says, does your life in Christ make you strong? Now, see, this should be a difference. There should be a difference in those of us that are Christians from the world. And because we're in Christ and Christ in us, we should be strong. But it asks you, does your life in Christ make you strong? Does his love comfort you? Do you have fellowship with the Spirit? Do you feel compassion and love for one another? Now, there's some questions for you to think about. Think of these later. Go over these at home. Then Paul says, I urge you then, make me completely happy by having the same thoughts, sharing the same love, and being one in soul and mind. And then he gives general instructions for righteous living for the Christian. Don't do anything from selfish ambition. Now, what is the world telling us to do today? To do what? Everything from selfish ambition. Look out for number 1. Take care of you. Don't let anybody get you. Don't let anybody take advantage of you. You watch out for number 1. And yet Paul tells us right here, don't do anything from selfish ambition or from a cheap desire to boast, but be humble towards each other, never thinking that you are better than the others. Now, isn't this exactly opposite from what the world is telling us to do? Be humble, never thinking that you are better than the others, and look out for each other's interests. Now, this advice can be for single people, it can be for married people, it can be ones that are working. Whatever person you're trying to get along with, it says, look out for each other's interests, not for your own. And then it tells you about your attitude. And what I like in the Bible is that when we are really dealing with God's truth for our lives, our circumstances may not change. But what do we know will change? Our attitude about the circumstance. And it tells us here that the attitude you should have is the one that Christ Jesus has. And it says in some versions, let the mind be in you, which was in Christ Jesus. That when we are truly committed Christians, that the mind of Jesus Christ is in me. And I can depend on that. I can't count on me, and I can't count on the world, and I can't count on institutions. But I can count on the fact that the Bible tells me that when I ask the Lord Jesus to come into my life and control me, that he's in me. And that I don't have to worry that my brain may not always work just correctly, and that I do everything just right, because I can depend on one thing for sure, that the mind of Christ Jesus is in me. And it says here he always had the very nature of God, but he did not think that by force he should try to become equal with God. Instead, of his own free will, he gave it all up. And there's some of you that have really had to give up a few things. And it says here that he took on the nature of a servant, a servant's attitude. He was born like a man. He appeared in human likeness. He was humble, and he walked the path of obedience to death, his death on the cross. And for this reason, because he was willing to be obedient, because he was willing to be humble himself, it says for that reason, that he was obedient and humble, God raised him to the highest place above and gave him the name that is greater than any other name, so that all beings in heaven and on earth and in the world below will fall on their knees in honor of the name of Jesus. And all will openly proclaim that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God the Father. Now, this is personal instruction for us. Now, the Bible has many other instruction, and we can't go through hours of looking these over, but I have given you verses here that will show you some of the things that tell you some information, some guidelines. And I want to look just quickly with you at Proverbs 31. And this especially pertains to marriage, but there's certainly not any woman at all that could find any problem or fault with this. It tells us how to be a virtuous woman. And I love so much of what it says in here that we could do a week's Bible study. I've done a 13-week Bible study on these verses, so I know how much there is in here and how long you could study them and look at them. But just to quickly see some of the things, because I have so many married women who tell me that they'd like to do what the Bible tells them, but they frankly don't know where to find it. Now, for those of you that are married and that this is a situation where you'd like to know some of the rules, look in here. Proverbs 31, starting with verse 10. And it asks a question that I think is so great a question for today. It says, who can find a virtuous woman? Now, is that a question for today? I mean, you know any? I mean, who can find a virtuous woman? And then it says, her price is far above rubies, and I'm sure it would be if we could find one. And then it says that the heart of her husband does safely trust in her. So just quickly, women, as we look at this in a fast way, can your husband count on you? Can he trust that when you say it, you mean it? Does he know where you've been? Do you tell him the truth about everything? Verse 12, she'll do him good and not evil all the days of his life. Now, I think that's a great one, that she'll do him good and not evil. Proverbs 12:4 says, a virtuous woman is a crown to her husband, but she that maketh him ashamed is as rottenness in his bones. I like that one, because there are some women that are constantly embarrassing their husbands and making him ashamed. But verse 12 says she'll do him good and not evil all the days of her life. 13, that she's going to work willingly. How many of you actually are working willingly around the house? My daughter Lauren once said to me, Mother, I hope I never have to grow up and be married and be miserable like you. I said, what do you mean? She said, you're always complaining. I said, I never complain. She said, yes, you do. I said, no, I don't ask my friends. She said, I don't need to ask your friends. I live with you. And that was damaging enough right there. And so I said, what do you mean? She says, well, you mumble all the time around the house. What do I have to do this for? I hate to make beds. Only people get into them again. Why should I make dinner? He probably won't come home. And I realized that I was working around the house, but I was not at all working willingly. And when I found this, it said, I'm to work willingly as unto the Lord. 14, that she is able to go out and bring in food from afar. Now, a loose translation of this verse, bringing in food from afar, means that the godly woman does not serve TV dinners every night. That's what it means. Verse 15 says that she gets up early. I talked to a principal recently in a school near us in a very fine, high-class area, and I asked him what some of the problems were they were having. He said, I guess if I were to say a number one problem, it's that 90% of my pupils come in the morning without ever having seen their mothers. And most of them haven't had anything to eat. And he said at least half of them, at one time or another during any given month, at least half of his pupils have no lunch or money for lunch. And he said, we actually run a loan program here in order to give out money because they haven't had any breakfast and they're about to die by lunch. Now, it tells us here that a godly woman gets up early and takes care of all these things. In 16, it says she thinks before she buys things. Now, you see all the good advice this gives here? When you really look at it, she thinks before she buys. Have you ever bought something without thinking and come home and there it was? I once was disturbed because my husband was away so much, I went out and bought an ugly coffee table. I mean, just a terrible, monstrous thing. It had a glass top and two boats underneath. A big ship like Columbus came over on it. I mean, what in the world I ever signed that I can't believe? I was angry at my husband because he wasn't home enough. And so I was going to show him. And I had to live with that set of boats for 10 years. It was terrible. I bought it without thinking. I wasn't doing what I should do. It tells us we're to think before we do these things. It says that we're to have strength, that we are to exercise, that we're to keep ourselves in good shape. It says that, 19, that she's always sewing and doing things around the house to make things better. Now, I can't say I do a lot with this. My husband said to me the other day, he said, you know why you haven't mended any socks in the last 5 years? And I hadn't realized I hadn't, but it's sure I haven't. And I said, why? He said, because I knew you wouldn't, so I've been throwing them all away when they got holes. And I thought that was very good of him, because he did realize that I wasn't too good on this verse here, laying her hands to the spindle. And so he threw away his socks. It says in verse 20, she stretches out her hand to the poor. She helps poor people, the ones that are in need. And it says, yes, she takes care of the needy. And it says that she dresses her household in scarlet. Now, I thought that was good. It shows that color is important in the Bible, that we're supposed to look right and bright. Verse 22, she makes coverlets of tapestry. Her clothing is silk and purple. She dresses well. She looks like a lady, not like a slob. When she goes out, she looks good. I've tried to train my daughters that when you walk out the door, you walk out in such a way that no matter what person in the world you meet, that you will look right. And my married daughter called me up one day and she said, Mother, I just called you up to tell you that something you said made sense. Now, that was encouraging. You may have to wait 24 years to hear that from a child. But she said something. She said, I went out this morning in cut-off jeans and a T-shirt. And she says, I was walking out the door. She said, it was like I heard your voice say, don't ever go out of the house looking any way. But if you met your husband downtown with a client, that he would be proud to say, this is my wife. And she said, I realized if I ever ran into Randy, and her husband is a very distinguished person, always in a suit and tie, she says that he would be humiliated to see me like this. So she said, I turned around, I went back in, and I got dressed. And she said, I just wanted to call you quickly and let you know that something you taught made sense. Now, you see, this is important, that we're to look good. We're to look right. We're not to be miserable and sloppy. And, you know, when I go into Kmart, my people-watching store, I am always amazed at some of the things that are in there. And you look at some of those girls that are only in their 20s with huge, fat, jiggly legs and shorts and a midriff here tied up there, and they're hanging all out of it, and they're pushing a little baby down the carriage, and they've got big pink curlers and rollers in their hair. And you look at that, and you think, that was once a bride. Now, you can be sure that no man ever married that. She didn't come down the aisle like that. She got that way later. Now, verse 25, strength and honor are her clothing, and she shall rejoice in time to come. And then 26, something we could all go by, married or not, it says here what?
She opens her mouth how? With wisdom. Have you ever not opened your mouth with wisdom? Do you know what it is to open your mouth and put your foot in it to say something that you can't say? That says here, a godly woman opens her mouth with wisdom, and in her tongue is what? The law of kindness. How many of you have already told me this weekend how unkind you were before you left home? The sarcastic things you said as you went, as you left. And when you get back home, you may find some problems too, because what's the biggest difficulty in having a mountaintop experience like this? You have to go off the mountain. And when you get down there, you may find all kinds of disaster have happened to you. And when you get down there, I would just want to caution you ahead of time, if they are still alive, rejoice. Expect nothing else. Verse 27 says that she takes care of her household, and I like this expression. It says she eateth not the bread of idleness. It means what? That she is not lying around in front of the television eating chocolates. That she is doing something productive and that she's up. And then verse 28 that I already gave you earlier today, it says here that when she is this kind of a woman, her children will rise up and call her blessed, and her husband also praises her. And he says to her, many daughters have done virtuously, and but thou art the most excellent of them all. Favor is deceitful and beauty is vain, but a woman that fears the Lord, she shall be praised. Now you see, very practical and simple instructions there for marriage. Many others that I've given down here that you can look at later. What does the Bible say about child training? Look with me in Deuteronomy 6, 5 through 7. A beautiful section in there. For those of you not too good in the Old Testament, it goes Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. Okay, can you get that far? Five in. Deuteronomy 6, verses 5 through 7. And it tells you here what you must do. And you know, it's interesting that we always would like to train our children without knowing anything ourselves. But unfortunately, we really have to do first before we can teach others. And it tells us this right here. Deuteronomy 6:5 says, and thou, meaning you parents, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, and with all thy might. Now, what does this mean? That you cannot teach your children to do that unless what? You have done it first yourself. So we first must love the Lord our God with all our heart, all our soul, and all our might. And these words which I command thee these days shall be in thine heart. And then read verse 7 with me. I have this in the King James. And thou shalt teach them diligently unto thy children, and shalt talk of them when thou sittest in thine house, when thou walkest by the way, when thou liest down, and when thou risest up. How often do you have to train children? All the time. Forever and ever. Sometimes someone will say, when do they ever learn? Never. And just because they got married doesn't mean your troubles are over either, does it, ladies that have married children? You still have some reflection and problem to be concerned with. We never will be through with it. And by the time they are out of the family and we've learned how to raise children, they're all gone and we're out of a job. So we can never know that they're going to be done. It's a never-ending process, but God said we had to do it. Now, there are many other instructions for child raising, but that, I think, is good. Look at Proverbs 22:6. This is a good one in here. There are many in Proverbs. If you look in this under child raising, you'll find so many good ones. And this one, Proverbs 22:6, tells us here, to train up a child in the way he should go. Now, this does not mean train up a child in the way the world tells you he should go, in the way he feels he should go, or in the way his friends feel he should go. Now, I always found in my children that when they came home and said, everybody is going, that it usually meant nobody was going yet, but we're all telling our parents that. So I would then say to them, I would then say to Marina, for example, who is everybody? Now, I found that was a good question to ask, because never yet did she have really a good concrete answer or a list in her hand. And I would say, when you give me a list of everybody, I will call them others. And if indeed everybody is going, then certainly you may go also. Now, I never got a list yet. So everybody is going is not the way we're to guide them, but it tells us here we're to train up a child, not in the way he wants to go or the way the world says, but what? In the way we know he should go. And when he is old, what? He will not depart from it. Now, what guarantee is not in there that we would like? What guarantee is not in there right now? He isn't necessarily going to like it right now or shape up right now. But it tells us when? When he's old, he'll appreciate you, and he'll realize that you trained him correctly. So that will help you and encourage you. And in Ephesians 6:4, it just says briefly, provoke not your children to wrath. And I find so many mothers that are goading on their children, who are egging them on, who are leading them into war every day. And it tells us there, provoke not your children to wrath. In the area of friendship, look in Genesis 50. Now, this is in the story of Joseph. And I just like this story, and this particular sentence I thought was good, because after Joseph had been sold into slavery by his brothers, and I don't imagine too many of you have had that happen to you, have you? Any here that was sold by your brothers? You see, it's hard to get a feeling of what Joseph went through, because none of us have actually done that. But even after that had happened to Joseph, he forgave them. And in Genesis 50, verse 21, he says, fear ye not. I will nourish you and your little ones. Now, this is the ones that had done him in. So those of you that are worrying about the people that do you in. Joseph said, I will nourish you and your little ones. And then it says, what did he do to really ones that had been his enemies? He did what? He comforted them, and he spoke kindly unto them. Can you do that with your friends, with your enemies? Can you comfort them and speak kindly towards them? It's very difficult to dislike or to hate a person whom you're praying for, whom you're speaking kindly to, and whom you're comforting. And when we're willing to do this to our friends, we will find that we will have a much better relationship and love with them. There are other verses here. I especially want you to know James 4:17, which says one thing that has really helped me a great deal in life. It says, to him who knoweth to do good and doeth it not, to him it is sin. Say that with me. To him who knoweth to do good and doeth it not, to him it is sin. How many of you, in thinking back over just the past week, knew something you should have done, where the Lord put it upon your conscience and your heart to do it, and you didn't do it? Now, it doesn't mean we can do everything in the world that ever comes along, but when the Lord puts it upon your heart to go see someone, to call someone, to write someone, whatever it may be, to him who knoweth to do good and doeth it not, to him it is sin. Now, let's ask one other question. What if it doesn't work for me? What if I try all these things and it doesn't really work? In Isaiah 30, verses 19 to 21, it tells us some very simple and basic things. It says here in verse 19 that if it doesn't appear to work right now, when will something happen? What does it tell us? Eventually, sometime in the future. It says eventually we will what? Weep. No more. Eventually, we will weep no more. Now, some of you that I've talked with today have really problems that you could weep about and that I could weep about and that have burdened me since I've talked with you. But it says here that even if the here and now is not what you want, and you don't think there's been any change since you've committed your life to the Lord or since you've been doing all the right things, it tells you here that eventually we will weep no more. And God will be gracious to us, and he will answer our prayers. But then it tells us, in the meantime, and this is what we have to bear with today, in the meantime, we may have to eat the bread of adversity. There may be some things that aren't the way we want them to be, and I like that term. We may have to today eat the bread of adversity. We may have to drink the water of affliction. And some of you are today drinking the water of affliction. But it tells you there is good teaching in the Bible available. And it says, when you are steeped in the Word, when you are following good teaching, the Word of God, when you are following this, it tells you that when you begin to turn to the right or the left, and you're not sure which path to take, it says you will hear in your ears the words, this is the way, walk ye in it. And when I saw that, that comforted me, because it tells me that when I'm doing the right thing, when I'm following God's plan for my life, and I say to myself, but it isn't working. Nothing's changed. I'm still sitting in the same circumstances I was before. This set of verses told me that eventually I will weep no more. Eventually God will be gracious unto me. Eventually he will hear my prayers and act upon them. But in the meantime, I may have to eat the bread of affliction. I may have adversity. I may have to drink the water of affliction. But when I stay with the Word, when I follow this, and when I begin to turn astray, when I begin to go wrong in life, when I begin to head to my own selfish pleasures instead of what God wants me to do, I will hear in my ears, this is the way, walk ye in it. And in conclusion tonight, ask one last question of yourself. Am I willing to do the right thing, regardless of the results? regardless of the reaction, regardless of the circumstances. In Philippians 2, 13 through 15, we see some verses that have been very meaningful to me. I've already given you today Philippians 2, 13 in the Good News Version that says that God is always at work in you to make you willing and able to obey his good purpose. If you're concerned, if you're sitting here as a little me by yourself, wondering why everybody's abandoned you, why there's no more hope in the world, it tells you here that God is always willing, always able to make you willing to do his will. And then the next two verses I'm going to do in the King James because this is the way I like them better. And these are the final instructions for us tonight as we leave and things for us to think about. It tells us that we, as Christian women, are to do all things without murmurings and disputings. We're to do what we know is right, regardless of people's reaction or response. We're to do what we know we should do without complaints, without running around and saying, poor little me, how put upon I am, how terrible it is, how many people have done me in. But I'm to do all things without murmurings and disputings, that I may be blameless and harmless, the sons of God without rebuke, in the midst of a crooked and perverse nation, among whom I shine as a light in the world. Now, are we today in the midst of a crooked and perverse nation? Are we in a godless society? Are we in a situation where all the things that we've had faith in the past have disappeared? And when we think of that, we have to realize that God has instructed us very clearly that we are to do all things without murmurings and disputings, that we may be blameless and harmless, the sons of God without rebuke, in the midst of this crooked and perverse nation, among whom we may shine as lights in the world. Now, where is the place for me in this kind of generation? If you look back at your circle in the center, and you look at the bottom, there's a star here. And what I have to do in this nation is not sit here as a little dismal blot, as a discouraged and depressed person, but I'm to realize that I am to shine as a light in the world, in the midst of a crooked and perverse nation. I hope tonight, as we've shared this together, that perhaps you've been able to see a difference between what the world is teaching and what the Lord is teaching us to do. And I'm hopeful and prayerful that as we depart one from another, that our aim from here on will not to be follow the whims of the world, not to run off on every new kick and every new thought that comes along, but to become so firmly grounded in the Word ourselves that we will be able to be truly, as Paul says, shining as lights in the world in the middle of a crooked and perverse nation. Let's hope this can be our wish from here.